This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law. Like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Sanbonani, I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is The Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Joining me again is Kate Pater. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Duncan. Hi, everybody.
And to you, Duncan.
Hi, world.
Good. Today's show is what we call warm and fuzzy.
Nice to have one of these. We've had some hard hitters recently.
It's all about the joy of giving. And we have four inspirational people, well, three in the studio and one on the phone, and they're going to be telling us about their individual acts of giving and kindness. Three of the guests are in studio, and the one on the line is from East London, I think, or somewhere in the Eastern Cape. Before we talk to our first guest online, Janet Stone from East London, let me introduce you to our in-studio Joys of Giving guests. And they are Bianca Petz. Welcome, Bianca.
Hi, nice to have me.
Dennis Jacobs.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here.
And attorney, respected attorney, Roy Suttner.
Hello, everyone.
Good. If you want to join with us today, 0861-555-189, you can message us, you can tweet us on Hertz Law, H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W. And if you're on the Cliff Central app, you can send us a message directly.
Yeah, so let us know. We'd love to have your thoughts in studio.
Okay, so last year, Kate, you remember we spoke to a man called Chris Bodgers.
Most definitely I remember that one.
And he's the man who had a kidney transplant.
That's right, and we spoke to him before that, in fact, when he was looking for a donor.
Okay, so today we've never really spoken to this lady. She's the person who is the kidney donor.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Her name is Janet Stone. Chris is the man who received it. He also lives in the Eastern Cape. He received her kidney. He was suffering from kidney failure. He could have died as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very serious situation.
So we last year when we spoke to him, he explained what he was going through. I'm just going to play a little bit of that clip or shortened version of our discussion with him. And then we'll speak to Janet, who's the donor. Chris, you told us about a year ago that you were a great surfer. You're 53 years old, or you were then, and something terrible happened to you. What was it?
Well, my kidneys failed in about 2 years ago. The kidneys failed, and that was the end of surfing, diving, long hikes along the coast. Mm. It was pretty much the end of life as I knew it. On the 26th of May, and you know, I still battle not to weep when I speak of this, but so excuse me if I do, but I was approached during dialysis by an old friend, Janet Stone, and Janet basically said to me, look, you're suffering, I'm here for you, my kidney is yours. Mm. She never once faltered, she never backed down, and there were some really, really difficult aspects to the process, but she was always there. And on the 26th of May this year, at the Chris Barnard Memorial Hospital, Janet's kidney left her body and was placed inside mine. Mm. I no longer have to go to dialysis anymore. And that in itself is unbelievable. Yeah. You know, I've got my life back.
Okay, that's the clip. You remember that, Kate?
Yes,
it was very,
very
touching.
Vividly.
It was very tearful. I think we all were in studio. We had a big studio that day, and most of us were tearful to think that some woman has saved the life of another. So we're going to speak to that woman. Her name is Janet Stone. Let's call on her to talk to us. Hello, Janet.
Hi, Gary.
Janet, you heard that clip?
I did. It's made quite an impact on me. I know Chris and I, we see each other quite often. But to hear that, it kind of brought everything back into focus again. It's been almost a year now. Mm. And, yeah, I think about it often, but mostly it feels like a dream.
So, Janice, you are living with one kidney and one was donated to Chris.
too close.
Yeah, yet. How are you doing health-wise?
Absolutely, 100%, absolutely. They did warn me that post-op for a couple of months I might feel just sort of very slight symptoms similar to what Chris was experiencing in renal failure, but obviously less pronounced.
Mm.
But I have to say that I donated the kidney on the Tuesday, the 26th. I was discharged on Friday. I flew back to East London on Sunday. And I must admit, against doctor's orders, on Monday I was back behind the wheel and fetching and carrying my grandchildren.
Wow. Janet,
so, week of recovery.
How close were you before this to Chris? Are you family or where do you fit in with
him? You know, it's quite strange. We were very close friends, he and Linda, his wife. They were teachers at the school that my children went to. And Chris played a very big part in my oldest son's schooling at that stage. We did quite a lot of things together. We went skydiving together. We used to go bird watching. We used to feed penguins, all sorts of things as a group with the children and Linda and Chris and myself. And but then, you know, once the children moved up in standard, we kind of went our separate ways. My husband and I moved up to Bloemfontein. Chris and Linda moved up the East Coast. And so we kind of lost touch, and then we connected on Facebook again. And then I happened to bump into Linda in a shop here in East London, and I asked how Chris was, and she then told me that he was on dialysis with renal failure.
Mm.
And it was weird because at the time, my gut instinct was to say, I want to help. But I figured at that point maybe there was a family member who would be prepared to or able to. You know, there are lots of boxes that have to be ticked. And so I kind of left it at that point, but it was in my mind all the time. And then there was a newspaper article which I happened to read. My husband gave it to me. And at the end of the article, it stated Chris's blood group. And it's my blood group. And as I read it, I just picked up my phone and I messaged him and said, listen, I'm the same blood group as you. We need to talk.
Mm.
And almost instantly he replied and said, well, I'm in East London for dialysis tomorrow. Let's meet beforehand. And we spoke for about 2 hours at that point. But at that point I said, look, you know, I haven't even spoken to my family. I'm happy to do it, but I do need to speak to them. My family and I have always been open about donation after death. So, you know, it wasn't a new discussion. It was just a new angle. And I spoke to the children, and they were all happy with it. And then I spoke to my husband. And he said, you know what, it's actually not a surprise. You've always wanted to be a donor. This is just a little bit sooner than expected. And so I contacted Chris and Linda and said, okay, it's a go. And from then it was the test.
Yeah.
That's completely remarkable.
Janet, how can Chris or anyone ever repay you for this?
There is no repayment. You know what? I think being alive and being able to witness the effect of donating a kidney is the most amazing reward. You don't need anything else really. Just to be able to see Chris come alive. He's able to do things he wasn't able to do. He's back to surfing, obviously much safer surfing, but he is surfing again. He's able to take long hikes. He's very much into nature. So, you know, all of these things, it's just amazing. And you know, Chris and Linda have a business which almost came to a standstill because of his illness. That's now picking up again. And, you know, to me, that's all the reward. You don't need anything else.
You've saved and you've changed the family's life as well. It's remarkable.
Exactly.
Absolutely. They say that you're never too old to donate an organ. What age were you when you donated this?
I was 56. I believe there are older donors, and I think so long as you know, your health is okay, you go through rigorous tests. They won't take a kidney if your health is questionable. So, I mean, one of the bonuses, obviously, is I've had just about every test one can think of.
And you're here for a long, long time, I hope.
Sorry?
And you're here for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah. I was given a clean bill of health. So I believe that I am going to be around for a long time. Not sure the family is happy.
I'm sure they are.
So, Janet, with one kidney, both of you have one kidney, you can live a normal, healthy life, both of you.
Absolutely. Yes. What happens is my kidney, my remaining kidney, has enlarged. That's why they say the first couple of months you may experience sort of tiredness. Personally, I felt a little bit in the first couple of weeks, but after that it was fine. But what happens is the kidney actually enlarges to take up the load of the missing kidney, and the same thing would have happened with Chris.
Yeah. I know that Chris told me, I think, that he sickled to get the right kidney. For a long time, he was struggling to find someone. And,
you know,
so many people die without getting the transplants. You kept him alive and he's alive.
You know, there are two things. One, I would urge people who are interested to please go onto the Organ Donor Foundation website. And I can give you the website.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, it's www.odf.
Okay, Organ Donor Foundation, yeah.
Yeah, .org.za.
Janet, you're a special angel, and I know that Chris wants to publicly thank you. And how do we do this? I mean, you'd like to stand on the steps of the town hall and say how wonderful you are, but we've done something special today on Cliff Central. We always pull rabbits out the hat. We've actually got Chris on the line right now, and we're going to bring, don't go away, we're going to bring him on, and he's going to talk to you and thank you. So,
oh, great. Thank you.
Chris?
Yes.
Hi. Talk to us. You've heard Janet saying what she did. How do you feel?
Well, I can't hear Janet right now. I can only hear you because my phone is away from the computer.
Oh,
but can she hear me?
Janet?
Yes, I can.
Yes, yeah.
How do I thank Janet Stone?
Yeah, how do you thank her? Yep.
You don't. You can't. This is unbelievable. It's, you know, there are, the reason that we are having this phone call right now, in other words, the reason that I'm alive to be speaking to you, the reasons are two people. My living donor, Janet. Hi, Janet. I love you, Janet. Thank you, Janet. And my life partner, the woman who married me in 1996, the unsung heroine, Linda Newton Bodges. Without those two women, we would not be having this conversation today. And without those two women in my life and their love, I would not have been able to pack my rucksack last Tuesday and hike 20 kilometers from Morgan Bay to Hugger Hugger along the coastline on my own. I wouldn't have been able to do that. And for me, that's the greatest thing in my life, to walk along the coastline, usually with my dog, and a lovely packed lunch that Linda's made for me. That's it. And I did it on Tuesday. I did it. I tested Sophia. I took her for a hike. Sophia is my new kidney, by the way. I took Sophia for a 20-kilometer coastal hike. I'm sorry?
Nice name.
Sophia, yes. It's a beautiful name. And we went walking together. We walked 20Ks. So Linda and Janet, you know, people say, how do you thank them? I don't know.
Janet?
You know, I think for Chris, the thanks is the fact that he's alive and enjoying his life. That is thanks enough for me.
Yeah, this is one of the most touching shows I've done in many a year, to getting the two of you together. And I think we all have tears in our eyes here in studio. It's wonderful news. It's happy. It's great.
It's beautiful.
I was glad to be here.
Well done, Janet. God will bless you for this. Yeah.
Yes, Janet. Contribute.
Roy Sutner. Yeah.
Janet, there's a Talmudic expression which says, "One who saves one life is as if you saved the world."
Mm, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's correct for sure.
Charles Dickens. I've also got a quote. He says, "No one is useless in this world who lightens the burdens of another." True as well.
Yes.
Well done to you, Janet, and all you did for Chris. Yeah.
Thank you for letting me share. And please, I just urge people to think about organ donation. It isn't necessarily for everyone, but there are plenty of people out there who I feel could if they just knew how to do it.
I think that Kate and I have expressed the view that unless you have a religious objection, when you die, you can...
Save seven lives.
Yeah, within your will, you can provide, within your living will or dying will, you can provide that your part should be donated or your body should be donated.
Yeah.
There are people looking for everything. There's eyes and every organ available is needed.
Yeah, well, you know, whatever is left, obviously can't give another kidney, but... when I pass on, if the other kidney's still fine, whatever else they can use, my family knows. And that's the important thing. Have the discussion with family while you're alive. Because, you know, not everyone can be a live donor. It's very special, and I would urge people to consider it. But, you know, once you've passed on, as you say, so long as there aren't any religious reasons not to.
Yeah.
If you are physically in condition to donate anything, please make it known to family. It's important.
Okay, good. That's Janet Stone. Yeah. Kate, you wanted to say something?
Well, that also, you can actually register as an organ donor on the Organ Donation Foundation website. Yeah. And look into it. If it's obviously each individual's choice, but there is a lot of good that can be done. And something which is actually quite controversial is now registering your children as possible organ donors, which I would also urge people to at least consider.
Yeah. Okay, Janet Stone, many thanks. Chris Bodgers, go well, both of you. We'll talk to you again in a year or so. We'll find out how you're doing. Keep well. God bless.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you.
Good.
Thanks.
How is that, guys? Yeah, touching, isn't it?
Touching, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk to another giver.
Do-gooder.
Well, do-gooder's got a negative connotation.
Well, not, It shouldn't. It really shouldn't, but okay,
we have a gorgeous young woman in studio. She's a mom. And what are you up to? Where's your giving? What are you doing?
I donate breast milk to the South African Breast Milk Reserve. So basically, whatever I don't give my son for school, whatever's left over gets donated to them.
Okay, you're a mom of how old is your son now?
18 months.
How long have you been donating your excess milk?
Since September 2014, so just over a year.
You are saving the lives of many.
Yeah.
Okay, they're prem babies that have to get mother's milk as such, right?
Yep.
You, forgive me for being a bit graphic, but how do you extract the milk? Is it done with the machine or how do you do it?
So you get the two options. You get the manual option, which you manually pump with your hands, and you get the electronic option, so it can be battery operated or plugged into the wall. Yeah. And then it will express into a bottle, which you can then, once it's full, you close it with the lid that it comes with, and you put in an empty bottle. Yeah.
And where does the bottle go?
SABR provides you with an empty bottle. In that bottle, you can put 200 mils of milk. You then got to seal it with an iron, so it looks like your Super M milkshake bottles. That's what it looks like. So you seal it with an iron, and then you got to put it into the freezer straight away.
Okay, now what about the danger of HIV within within the donor's milk?
Okay, so since HIV is passed through blood, they cannot take the risk when it comes to preemie babies. So generally, if you're HIV positive, you cannot donate milk.
So your milk's got to be pasteurized, is that
That's
what they
correct,
call it?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Now, there are little ones out there. We talk of infants that are dying. Yes. The stats are too terrible. According to South African Breast Milk Reserve, a premature baby dies every 20 minutes in South Africa.
Yep.
Frightening, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're losing all these kids. Yes. With the milk, we could save it, I think, in the first 2 weeks. If you give the breast milk, it can save the life of these infants. Is that right?
Yeah, that's
so
correct.
So, probably unbeknown to you, you're saving the lives of many.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Maybe thousands.
Maybe thousands, yeah.
How many bottles have you?
Well, it's 100 liters is what I reached now recently. So if you put that into perspective, that's 50 2-liter bottles that you would buy at the shop.
You wrote on your Facebook page, and we stalk here, you know, my researchers stalk. She says, you said, it's a rather strange or rather large milestone for me. I would really just love to share my incredible moment. This is 4 liters off to South African Breast Milk Reserve. This now makes up 100 liters I've donated over the year in a bit. And we'd like to applaud you for that. And I think we're all going to give you a round of applause. I mean, that's really fantastic.
Thank you.
You know, we talk of one life. God forbid it's your own little infant.
Yeah.
Here we don't know where it's going and who's benefiting from it.
Yeah.
But you do some unbelievable work, don't you?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And those tiny, tiny babies in the NICU, I mean, really, 25, 26 weeks, you're talking about 5 mils a feed.
That's it.
So if you've actually donated 100 litres, the number of lives you possibly have affected is vast.
Yes.
So well done you, Bianca.
You don't get paid for this, Bianca. This is mahala, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
and no one gets paid anything for this.
No, and you know what? I don't think you need any form of payment. This is, you know, you saving lives. That's payment enough.
If you hadn't done this, where does the milk go? Does it go down the drain?
Yep. Down the drain.
How long can you keep donating?
You can keep going. As long as you're making milk, you can keep going. Mothers who do have excess milk tend to freeze milk for their own babies. In a deep freeze, you can keep it up to 12 months. In a normal freezer, you can keep it up to 6 months. But, you know, I've never been in the position where I've needed to freeze milk for a later date. So it's better to then just donate.
Yeah, I read somewhere that orphaned and abandoned babies through HIV, these are HIV babies, are receiving the gift of this immune-boosting breast milk, and it's been donated in KZN, where they have a terrible HIV problem.
Mm.
There's a woman called Dr. Anna Kutsuda. She's a professor there. I haven't spoken to her. I just read her article. And she said that in one case, the baby went from being very malnourished to thriving after getting donor milk.
Yep.
So it does work. What you're doing is fantastic. I want to ask you something else. There was some woman who was on a plane from in South Africa, I don't know where she was off to. The cabin crew or an air hostess asked, she was breastfeeding, and asked the woman to get up off her chair and go into the toilet if she wanted to breastfeed. What's your feel on that one? I know it's a slightly off point, but you know, how would you react?
It's a very sensitive topic, unfortunately. You know, breasts for a man is sexual. Breasts for a woman and her child is purely for food. And I think it's very difficult for a man to separate the two. Mm. But essentially, you know, if you're sitting at a restaurant and a waiter brings your burger and says, right, go sit in the bathroom and eat it, you're definitely not going to do that.
Absolutely,
so I don't see why a child should feed in the bathroom.
Yeah, Kate, you have a view on this.
Well, I mean, yes, it can actually be done quite discreetly, but I don't think that's necessary. I think if a child needs sustenance and you are breastfeeding, quite honestly, you should be able to pretty much whip out your breast wherever you are and feed your child.
Yep.
The sexualization of an act like that is actually quite perverted if you think about it. So, you know, we all know the benefits of breast milk. Some mums can't breastfeed, some mums elect not to, and that's absolutely your choice. But for breastfeeding mums, I think that actually society should rally around them. They're doing something excellent if they can do it. And rather than making it a shameful act or one that you need to go and isolate yourself to do it where you are.
Yep.
I think the Health Minister, Dr. Erin Motsoaledi, when he heard this incident on the plane, he lambasted the airline and said, absolute nonsense. There is no law preventing a woman from breastfeeding her child anywhere. You can do it anywhere. So please do. Yeah, if you need to breast milk, do it.
I will do.
Absolutely. Am I right? Well, you won't have to, I don't think.
No, we passed that stage now. My son drinks from a bottle. But, you know, if I have to, and I have been in instances where we're out and I haven't packed a bottle and I have to do it, but then I just cover, that's me.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to bash a woman or not support her if she doesn't cover. In fact, I will support her 1,000%.
Agreed.
We're talking about milk. Donors, we have a message here, Gab. My husband wants to donate his sperm, but I can't bear the thought of other women raising his babies.
I think that's slightly different to breast milk, quite honestly. I mean, this is actually sort of biological material. And I think you actually get a say whether your husband wants to donate his sperm or not.
Okay. There's an organization called, is it La Lech or something?
Lalish League.
Lalish, okay. Tell us about them and how they helped you and how others can get in touch with them.
Okay, so Lalish League is also a volunteer system. You get leaders who advise what medicines you can take, what food you can eat, how to latch. They volunteer their time to help mothers. They have a group on Facebook called Lalish League, I think South Africa. So you can join that group. There are close to 20,000 women on that group that will also help you if a leader doesn't get in touch. And the support there is amazing.
Okay, good. Roy and Dennis, anything you men wanted to contribute on this, or is it not a man's discussion? Dennis?
Oh, I'd love to contribute.
How do you feel about it?
I hardly ever, when we're going to speak about ministry, have to deal with breasts and sperm. But no, I agree. I mean, I think it's a personal thing. I think, you know, in terms of whether you do it outside or you hide, it's really a personal choice.
Yeah, our attorney, Roy Sutton, has got a view on everything, Roy.
Yes, the highest form of charity is to give to someone who doesn't know who the giver is. And this is really the highest form of charity, to give of your breast milk.
Yeah, you know some good stuff, Roy.
Thank you, Gary.
That makes you a good lawyer.
I had a good teacher, your dad.
Okay, excellent on that one. What we're going to do now is we're going to break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a man who serves the community. He goes to some horrific parts of the prison, the maximum section, and he ministers to people who have got life sentences. We're going to take you through that. Dennis, let's break. We'll be right back.
This is CliffCentral.com.
I am the future of South Africa. On my shoulders, I carry the hopes and dreams of generations to come. I'm eager to learn, but even more eager to use my knowledge for good. I know that it's not where I come from, but where I'm going to that really matters.
At Sibanye-Gold, we believe our youth is worth its weight in gold, which is why we are so committed to developing, nurturing, and grooming our young people into future leaders. Sibanye-Gold, we are one.
I patiently waited for you for 9 months. I would sit in my chair and talk about how I longed to meet you. I knew you'd be the most beautiful baby in the world. I was ready for you, but I wasn't ready for this. If you have a child in need of reconstructive surgery, Smile Foundation can help you. Visit www.smilefoundation.co.za or call us on 0861 276 453.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and we're discussing today the giving and the kindness of giving and the joy of giving and the wonderful people that serve others and do great things.
Yeah, look, I mean, society seems to be so programmed towards takers. It's really nice to talk to some of the givers.
Yeah. Let's talk to our next guest, Dennis Jacobs. It's Jacobs, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So, Dennis, if I may, can I call you a lay pastor? And I think there's something in saying that you're a disciple of Jesus, which is a bit embarrassing for you, but you are.
No, yeah. Not for me at all.
Good. You're a prison pastor, lay pastor.
Yes.
In America, I think they call that the man who goes to the yard or something, don't they?
Yeah. I think it's slightly different in South Africa.
Okay, so you're one of a group from the, what church are you guys from?
It's a number of churches. We do it together. It's a a joint effort. I come from the Bryanston Catholic Church, and we have Methodists, we have people from all kinds of churches. It is a Christian ministry, so we go as a group of Christians, and every Saturday we go to one of the maximum security prisons and we run a ministry, and we get to speak to the prisoners.
Okay, obviously you need permission for this, which is easily obtained. Are you welcomed or not really?
We're very welcomed.
Do you have to sign any secrecy forms, or can you tell it the way you see it there?
No, we do. We sign a whole lot of forms. Yeah. I mean, they give us all kinds of clearance. But we've been doing it for a long time. The ministry has been in that prison for, it must have been 10 years now. I've been there for about 3 years at this prison. Mm-hmm. So we are welcomed. I mean, we find that when we arrive there on a Saturday, the officials are always happy to see us. They know that when we leave, things are calm. We often have, if there's incidents of fighting or gangs, that, after we go in, things have just calmed down.
All right, so firstly, you go into the maximum section.
Yes.
Now, what kind of people are there?
Well, it's life sentence. So it would be guys that have, are murderers. It's a male prison that we go into, so it's all men. Yep. So it's murder, it's rape, pedophiles.
These are guys that are there for the rest of their lives, really.
That's right, yeah.
How do they welcome you?
Well, it is a process. I mean, when we get there, the first, we go through a 14-week program. And I think in the beginning, many of them come because they want a certificate. But, our ministry is really just to introduce them to Jesus and to Christianity. And we find that, that sort of does its own work. We just present it. We present the gospel and we watch as they grow. So after sort of 3 or 4 weeks, you can already see that they've changed. That things are
I'm going to be a little cynical with you. Sure. Do these people get some kind of certificate that counts towards early release?
Yes. Everything they do in the prison, so whether they do anger management, whether they do a Christian course, it goes onto their file, and that is then, when they go for parole, if they can go for parole, then they would use that.
So do they elect to be part of this group?
Yeah, there's within the prison, there are people who have, inmates who have done this all before, and they go and they speak about it. I mean, one of the parts of the course is telling others.
Yes.
And so they'll go and tell others, and they attract other people to come to the course.
How many people do you get to sit with on the weekend?
We have a group now of about 80. It varies. So 80 to 100 inmates, and we go in as a group of 15 to 20 people. Yeah.
Do you know what offences they've committed? Do you know why they're there?
Yeah, I don't know everyone's, but
What is the most common there? Is it murder and rape and that terrible?
No, it's probably these days. I think it's the violent, armed robbery, hijacking. But we do. I mean, there's mixed among you can't tell. There's no signs or anything. But
yeah.
And in fact, it's quite a thing because you wouldn't tell if everyone took off their orange and we were all sitting there with them. We look exactly the same as they do. You can't tell.
Is the color mix there?
There is. What we have predominantly. We have predominantly black inmates that come on the course. I mean, I've never counted the prisoners. So I just happen to know that there's only one or two. White people that are on our course. Yeah.
Dennis, do these people confide in you ever? Do they tell you that there are horrific things happening to them sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, one of the themes of the course is forgiveness. And part of forgiveness is that you verbalize or you get things out. So most of the guys are, I mean, they've been convicted.
Yeah.
So it's not whether they are guilty or not. Mm. It's that they have to come to terms with it themselves. So part of that process is they talk about it. And what we do, we have a group session every week where they break into groups of 10 or 12 and they talk amongst themselves. It's not to us. We facilitate a conversation. And it's during those conversations that guys, for the first time, really get to talk. One of the things we found, particularly in prison, is that people don't get to talk. Often these guys have never been able to talk about what they've done.
So they're defending themselves always rather than actually engaging with other
Absolutely,
people.
Absolutely, yeah. So this gives them such a good opportunity, and it's strangely enough, in where it is, it's such a calm environment, where the guys just openly share. It takes them a while. They've got to get used to the place. We have we don't force anyone to talk. We don't insist that they do anything, actually. They can come and stand in the corner if they feel like it. And we do have instances where guys will just sit and say nothing for 12 weeks. And then on the last week, we'll say, this has been great, and walk off. But we generally see them again. We go sort of twice a year, 14 weeks. So.
What about Bibles? Who donates that?
We get it from all over. The ministry we run is called Alpha.
Yeah.
So there's an Alpha ministry who goes and fundraises. You know, we have people on our team that will pay to buy Bibles. We get them from all over. In fact, my house at the moment, we have a new couch, which is boxes of Bibles covered with a blanket, which is ready to go to the prison.
Who donates that?
There is actually an anonymous donor who did it through Alpha. We put out a plea. We said, listen, we need about, you know, for the year, probably 200 to 300 Bibles, and they arrived at my house.
What's the cost of a Bible today if you're going to one of their retailers?
Sure, some of these, I mean, the one that I've got is probably only about 100 rand, but they're 100, 200, 250 there.
Yeah, they're expensive. Sure.
It's the most stolen book in bookshops.
Yes, I heard
that. Gary came across that a while ago, and I was absolutely astounded. He came to me and he asked me, what do you think is the most sort of stolen book in bookshops? And I kind of said, well, Harry Potter. And he said, well, the Bible. So, unbelievable.
That's a good sign. It means people want to read it.
Yeah.
Although they're going about it slightly wrong, I think.
Yeah, we don't judge. Eh?
Okay.
Hey, so if you can just stop.
Got it.
So, Dennis, I was really surprised to see that your Pope Francis, the current Pope, he also visits those in prisons personally. He goes in.
Yes.
Is that a first for a Pope?
Yeah, in my lifetime. I mean, the popes that I knew, obviously growing up, were a lot more staid and you know, I never saw a Pope walking around. I always saw them in those bubble cars. Yeah. But, you know, this in the, if you know anything about Catholicism, this is the year of mercy. And so one of the things he does is he leads from the front. He says, listen, we must do what it says in the Bible. We must go and visit prisoners. We must help the sick. We must spread the good news to the poor.
I think he's referring to, I looked at it, St. Matthew's Gospel, where it says, I was naked, you clothed me. Mm. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to visit me.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, you live by that, don't you?
Yeah. I do, yes. You know, I've told people, my mom asked me actually at the beginning of the year, because we have had scary incidents at the prison. And she
asked me, why do this? You're putting your life.
Yeah, she said, why are you going there? She's a born again Christian. She kind of knows my heart. So, you know, the reason you do it, it's not actually because, you know, the Pope does it or that someone does it. It's really a calling. It was just one day. I never grew up thinking, I think I must go to prison. It was only on the day that I arrived there and I realized this is really where I'm meant to be. So it is a calling. It's something that happens in your life, I think, once you...
Does it give you joy to give? Make you feel good?
Absolutely. But, you know, I'm very sort of careful about the... Like you used the word do good. It's not really for that purpose. I'll be quite honest. At the, you know, when Jesus left, he sort of said, go and tell others. And that's what we're doing. You know, it's not necessarily to feel good, but it is certainly a byproduct to see, you know, to see a man that, you know, has never known love in his life, has got to the age of 50, has murdered someone and doesn't really know how to deal with it. To watch a man like that cry and a man like that break and a man like that built up and do that in the name of Jesus is, I mean, that gives you something. And so I'm very blessed that I get to do this, yes.
I'm sure a lot of these people who are there for life have lost hope. I mean, what's life all about,
absolutely,
really? There's nothing left for them.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. When we arrive there, you have a group of hopeless people that walk into the room we use. And within 14 weeks, you know, my Bible tells me when people, you know, when you meet Jesus, things change. It's not just a spiritual thing. People change physically. They start to look different.
Do you see it happening in front of you?
Absolutely. We do. We specifically on day one will watch them as they come in the door just to take note.
Yeah, their body language is aggressive. Their arms are folded.
Absolutely,
they stare you in the eyes.
They're down.
Yeah.
You know, their heads hang. And there's a lot of pretense, you know, and bravado.
Yeah.
And that sort of, it just melts away after kind of 3-4 weeks. Yeah.
I guess they feel they've been abandoned by society, by God, by everything.
Absolutely.
And you instill...
Yeah. I mean, most of them have never had a family life. I mean, most of the guys that we speak to didn't have a father. You know, they didn't know their father. Obviously, they had a father. They didn't know their father. Mm. Or they grew up on their own. So that whole breakdown of family life. And that you get to a point where you start to understand that they've done horrific things. But
because
we're
they were treated horrifically.
Absolutely. And it's not an excuse, but you come to understand that we are so blessed with the lives that we have because of the families that we have.
Yeah.
And without that, it's...
Are these people now accepting God and Christianity in your case? Do they accept it now, or they...
Yes, I'd love to say that 100% do, but we offer it for everyone. It's an introduction to Christianity, but we find that through the 14 weeks there's a huge change. You know, people that they didn't believe come to that place where they believe.
Well, I must say, you are the least Bible-bashing Christian I think I've ever met. And
we were speaking about breasts, so I have to tone down. Yeah.
But, I mean, you're not trying to enforce your opinion on anybody. In fact, if anything, you're quite sort of apologetic, yes. Disciple of Jesus and all of that.
I am,
but
yeah.
It's a nice way to actually engage with somebody because it's open and it's honest and it's not in your face.
Yeah, I think people get confused because Christians today, I think... have forgotten that not everybody bought the same ticket, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, I bought a ticket to this. I took a step forward. I said, listen, I accept you. Jesus is my Savior. But not everyone did. And my call as a Christian is not to bash you with my Bible. It's to live as a Christian, to live as what this book says and what Jesus taught me. And hopefully that will convince you rather than the things that I say. And so that's why it is a bit difficult. I'm not apologetic, in case you...
Sorry, no, wrong
I'll
word.
I'll call it humility. Yeah.
Dennis, there's one thing that I found quite interesting. Condoms are being dished out in their millions to these prisoners. We know why. There's no women there. How do you feel about that? And what do they say, the prisoners? Do they talk to you about this? Or
no. I don't think... I mean, I've never had a condom conversation with a prisoner. I've never spoken about soap dropping in the shower. No, I've never had those conversations. I mean, I have obviously personal views.
We understand that.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, a lot of them are being raped. Does that ever come up? That's probably the biggest fear of any man in a prison.
Well, I think
they're there for life.
There's a hierarchy in a prison. I mean, much the same as any difficult place. There's a power struggle.
Do you get to see it? Do you see who the leaders are and who the...
It's all under the surface. We have, you know, on an ongoing basis, we'll have gang members that will just come to the course to keep it a look at what we're doing.
Okay.
We see all of that struggle, but we don't. I don't see a lot of violence. I've seen it once or twice, but we are always conscious of where we are. It's not men that going. Probably there's two or three men. The rest are women that go in.
That's interesting.
So it's a mixed bunch. I mean, there's religious nun sisters that come with us. I haven't seen overt violence much. But we know it's there.
You know, you're a good man, Dennis Jacobs. You and your crew.
Thank
and well
you.
Done.
Thank
good
you.
Stuff. Let's talk to a caller. Is it Stasha Jordan? Stasha?
Yes. Yes, good day.
Hi, Stasha, Executive Director, South African Breast Milk Reserve. You people do wonderful work. Where do you distribute the, we want to know that, where does the milk go to the donor milk?
The donor breast milk is targeted for mostly premature infants in neonatal intensive care settings whose mothers are unable to breastfeed. We obviously prioritize the need that is in the public sector because we often find that prematurity, HIV, and necrotizing enterocolitis, which is an infection of the gut that is very specific to the preterm baby, are directly associated are mostly affecting the public sector hospitals. But obviously, we have instances in private facilities where mummies will have HELLP syndrome, mummies will be in a coma, and mummies will be struggling to lactate. And in the first few days of life, we use donated breast milk to, in fact, lower the chances of sepsis and necrosis in the newborn, or more precisely, the premature infant. So our babies are between 450 grams and 1.8 kilos. Generally.
Okay, so Stasha, one question to you. Our guest in studio today, the wonderful Bianca Petzer, has donated roughly 100 liters. How many babies has she saved?
It's probably quite a few units of babies. You must imagine that a preterm baby of 450 grams takes as little as 0.8 of a mole every 3 hours. And obviously these volumes grow over time to larger volumes of like 10, 15, 32 moles. Okay, so if you do the math, you know, if he has saved innumerable lives. I mean, it's difficult to say in a number like this off the top of my head. We'd have to sort of quantify. But different patients take different amounts. But as I say, the smallest amount is 0.8 of a mole, which is literally a drop of milk, and that saves a life.
Excellent. It's not how much we give, but how much love we put into giving.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's an important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you want to ask, Stasha? You want to ask something, Bianca?
We are looking for mummies to donate, and let me tell you, this is quite an important time of the year because we are beginning to fill the reserve as over winter. The demand for donated breast milk grows because we have mummies that are a lot sicker and babies that consequently will need breast milk. So we are shouting out to all the listeners that are breastfeeding, that are healthy, that are not drinking or that are not taking heavy medication, to please consider donating. It really is a life-saving initiative. So many babies benefit from this. Many lives were saved last year. We saved 2,839 babies that otherwise would have succumbed. So there is a great opportunity to make a difference, and we invite all mommies and daddies and families to support breastfeeding. Excellent. And to support breastfeeding mothers. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Well done to you. Excellent.
Thank you. Have a lovely day.
What a
Bye.
Show this has been. Oh, I tell you, it makes me feel good. Okay, let's talk to one of my favorite people. He's attorney Roy Suttner. Roy, we're going to play a little clip of something, and then we'll talk to you.
How to sue in small claims court. If you're having trouble collecting money from someone, consider using the court system. You will need court forms, information and evidence, preparation skills, knowledge of court etiquette, confidence, and tenacity.
Okay, so what is Roy Suttner doing here amongst breast milk donors and kidney donors and lay preachers? He's a small claims court commissioner. He works after hours in his own time, sometimes from 5 o'clock at night until 11 at night, hearing these people slugging it out in small claims court.
Yes, just to digress for a second and to comment on Dennis Jacobs and going to the prisons. I've been to the prisons. It's not the most pleasant place to go to.
You get paid to go there, though.
Yes, very much so. But I do recall a case when I went to the prison and I had a new receptionist. And everybody who phoned in that day was told, no, you can't speak to Mr. Suttner. He's gone to prison.
Unfortunately, it was only for a visit. Okay, so Roy, you your act of giving to the community is to serve as a commissioner of the Small Claims Court. Matters come there like anything under 15,000.
Yes, so there's certain restrictions, but it's basically landlord-tenant disputes, motor vehicle accidents, debt, various smaller things.
Okay. Has anyone ever sworn at you?
Yes, I have been sworn at. Not often, but
I'd
it
like
does happen.
I'd like to as well occasionally. What do I mean? What? Like what?
The
what?
Particular instance that I recalled was a young lady had rear-ended another vehicle at a stop street. So it was pretty clear that she was responsible for what had happened. And I gave judgment against her. And her father got most irate. He was very upset. And I had to calm him down. I said to him, tell me, sir, do I know you? Why would I decide against you, you know, if I don't even have any... But it was so clear that she was at fault that there was no doubt. It does happen occasionally. They're supposed to have a policeman in the court, but often there's no policeman.
Are you ever
in
danger, Roy? Do people get aggressive?
I have heard of cases where people get extremely aggressive, particularly if they are not successful.
Radovan Kretcher was in court yesterday, and he asked the... Judge Lamont, to recuse himself. Have you ever had that?
Not
from him, but I think if I saw him coming into court, I'd run the other way. Yeah,
I have had instances where I've been asked to recuse myself, and I've offered to recuse myself.
Have you ever had a case where you've known one of the litigants?
That's the case where I offered to recuse myself, and the other side elected to have me, notwithstanding that I knew the one side, and in fact I held against the person I knew.
Was he
Did
an
you
attorney
see him
as well?
Again?
Yes.
Was he a lawyer, Roy?
No, he was not a lawyer.
Okay, so How does it work? I mean, what makes you serve? How do you get called on?
You get appointed. I was appointed in January 1997 by the Minister of Justice. You just really have to, I think, be 5 years as an attorney or 7 years, and then you can apply to be a commissioner of the small claims courts. There's small claims courts throughout the country.
You get paid nothing for this.
No, you don't get paid.
You're kind of like the Judge Judy of the South African courts, small claims commissioners, aren't you? I mean, that's the way it's done, really. No, there are no lawyers allowed in these proceedings, and the people have got to slug it out on their own.
Sometimes you'll have a commissioner with a little bit of, he's been watching Judge Judy and he likes to show off a bit, but generally it's as in most South African courts, there is a bit of decorum, and one tries to not make it too entertaining, although recently it happened to me where the litigants had finished and I'd finished with their case and they would continue to stay in court. And I said, well, you know, you can go now. Why are you still here? And they said, no, they're finding it very entertaining. They want to stay.
Roy, you could make millions. Do you know, I may be wrong, but I think to an extent, after Oprah, Judge Judy was one of the highest grossing shows.
That is true. She is.
I don't know if she's still alive, or we see.
Yes, she's still alive.
Do we see these old recordings? I think they date back for years. I don't know.
I think she's still around.
My elderly
well.
Mother loves Judge Judy. Yeah.
I don't think anyone doesn't. I mean, it really is. It's very theatrical and quite entertaining.
Roy, people come to court. I've seen a picture of a guy coming with a big Mickey Mouse shirt. I've seen one guy had a T-shirt that had you tickle my fancy, and underneath and I'll tickle yours. I mean, you get all kinds of characters coming to court. What's the dress code there?
No, it's supposed to be fairly formal. I've never had to reprimand anybody, but I have had people come in shorts. It's a small claims court, and so the idea is to be equitable and dispose and help people to resolve disputes where they've got no other redress. Mm.
What did you do with the guy in shorts? Did you send him home, or you?
No. On the contrary, I heard him out.
Roy, the problem with small claims court, the against, is that people do get their judgments fairly from commissioners because it's all lawyers that are serving freely. But the problem is getting the money, executing. They battle to get the money. Have you heard that?
That is true, but generally there are problems in executing even in large civil claims, so yeah.
I think
different.
Kate and I went to, was it you and I, Kate?
Yes,
we went to the
was.
Alex in Alex Township. We went to the small claims court there just to have a chat to them, and they said the complaint, well, people standing around said they won their case and they just can't get their money.
But I mean, it was for 300 rand, and then really to get the sheriff to go and get the money costs more than the 300 rand, which they couldn't afford in the first place. So they've got their judgment, but yeah, recovery is a different story.
Recovery is always a problem. Mm.
It's a problem in any court, I suppose. It's easier to get the judgment than get the money.
100%, yes.
Roy, you sit there sometimes till 11 at night.
No, very rarely. I normally sit till about 7 or 8.
Okay. Give us some idea of what people, you know, whether people should use the small claims court. Is it a good forum for claims under 15,000?
I found it to be an excellent, and it does work. In a large number of cases, people will actually, you know, pay over the money that they may owe in front of me. I've seen it work generally very, very well over many years. Obviously, there are going to be people who are not happy with it, who don't like the judgments, or who don't get their money when they've got a judgment. Yeah. But generally, it works quite well. I mean, I've had a case once where there was a dog lover and a cat lover who were next door neighbors, and they sued each other over a cat that had been killed by a dog. And the man refused to pay, and they were fighting. And eventually, as they were leaving the courtroom, and I gave judgment against the dog owner, and I said to him, listen, you guys are neighbors. You love dogs. They love cats. And he said, yes, you're right. I'm just going to pay. And he took out 1,000 rand and paid over to the cat owner. Mm. So, it serves a positive function.
Yeah, talk about fighting like cats and dogs, Roy. Yeah. Okay, so I also sat once as a small claims court commissioner some years ago. I remember some guy had a white suit that he took to the cleaners, and when he got them back, the suit was full of burn marks and stuff. So he went back to the cleaners and said, listen, pay me, you've messed up my suit, and they wouldn't. So he came to small claims court, and he got his judgment, and he got paid. Excellent.
Yes, I've had similar cases to that.
Yep. Dennis, We're going to say goodbye to everyone now. It's been a marvelous show. Thank you for all you do. Yes. It's good stuff. Yeah.
I'd just like to thank all the other people. I mean, the, you know, kidneys and all the, you know, saving lives of babies and what you do in court. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yep. One question I wanted to ask you, Dennis. Don't the prisoners get a bit attached to you sometimes? And after 14 weeks, you got to say goodbye. And that's the end of that.
Can you see me?
Camilla.
No, they don't. No, we go back twice a year. No, they don't. Part of the process is we let them get to know each other. Yeah. And often you find those friendships are what sustain them.
Yeah. Kate, anything before we...
No, just really nice to meet people who are doing good things. And look, there are plenty of movements around. And I think if we can all just do something good whenever we can, then the world might actually be a bit of a better place.
Yeah.
Okay, so someone who's walked into our studio today, and I've got 5 minutes with her, it's our very good friend, Sue Ellen Sheehan. And I've grabbed her and said, come here, Sue Ellen, I want to talk to you. Bob Hewitt is appealing his sentence, am I right?
Hi, Gary. Yes, yeah. He is indeed.
Okay, you are the lady who was raped by Bob Hewitt when you were 8.
I was 12 years old.
12 years old. Mm. Okay, he has said that he's appealing, and he said that the sentence was too high.
Yeah, he seems to be of the opinion that what he did was not that serious that it deserves jail time. It's like hitting someone on the head with a spade and calling it gardening.
Yeah, he says his lawyers argue that the attack on you guys, you children, was not cruel or callous, and he deserves to be kept out of jail. Now, he's been given a 6-year sentence, right?
He has, yeah.
He's trying to get a suspended sentence?
I think he's actually, yeah, he hasn't asked to have his sentence completely removed. He's asked for a lesser sentence.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure that I want to put out there that I hope he gets a higher sentence, but I do think it's time he actually goes to jail. What he did. Yeah, you know, he's also of the opinion that there's been no psychological damage to any of us. I don't quite know how he comes to that, because it was never questioned and it was never presented. So I don't know where he can make a statement like that. Mm. I think it's a disgrace. I mean, I've read the documentation that's been submitted to the courts, and it's absolutely shocking. And that he can think that he is of such a class that he shouldn't go to jail. He's low class.
Yeah, we need to set an example here. This is a man who's molested and raped young girls, and the man should go to jail. There's no doubt about it. Well, in fact, he stands the risk of getting a higher sentence.
Yeah, when they said that they were going to appeal, Judge Bert Bam actually did tell him that he runs a risk of getting a higher sentence. But, you know, people don't know this. They were not only 3 of us. More than 70 women spoke out against him. I know of 3 boys personally who had incidences with him. I don't know what the incidences were, but there were incidences. It's disgraceful. And because he is who he is, he must go to jail, whether or not he's just from the streets or he's high class. He must go to jail.
Okay. So, Ellen, thank you for this. Sorry we didn't spend more time. We can talk to you on the phone next week or so.
Yeah,
we'll bring
it
up. I'd just like to say thank you to everyone. It's been a wonderful show. Thank you, Kate Pater, Duncan Mabaso, to our researcher, the very lovely Brigitte Meyer. Thank you to you. And we'll see you again all next Tuesday at 12 noon.
This is CliffCentral.com.